Okay.
This is an interview with Jerry DeGrice, recorded for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection. I'll be speaking with Jerry about his life as a landscape architect and ideas man. He's based in Hobart. This interview is taking place on Friday, the 26th of April, 2024, in Hobart, Tasmania. The interviewer is Jean Elder and our recorder is Rhonda Hamilton. The Australian Garden History Society acknowledges traditional owners of country throughout Australia. We pay respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island cultures and to elders past, present and emerging. So welcome, Jerry.
Thank you.
We'll start at the beginning.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you the year you were born and where you spent your early years.
Right. I was born in 1952 in the city of Detroit, Michigan, in the United States. Your listeners would understand Detroit as a city in decay at present, but as a child, it was a great place to grow up. I lived in tree-lined streets with elms, American elms, reaching all the way across the street from both sides to create a cathedral-like avenue into the distance, Jeffersonian grid of streets. So, you know, everything was in rectangles and we could walk, play in the streets, we could walk to school, ride our bikes everywhere in the neighborhood. It was a really a great childhood. And everybody had a neat and tidy front lawn. And
no fences?
No fences, backyard fences, and that was one of the fun things to do as a child was to jump all the fences down the street to the next street. But in the front yards were all well trimmed and whatnot, and that's sort of the beginning of my landscape roots in a way, because Mr. Page's house was about four doors up, and he let me push his lawnmower across the front lawn for $2 at aged eight, and it all took off from there. So the lawn mowing side of landscaping was a big part of my childhood. In later, you know, 12, 13, I used to tow my lawnmower down into the wealthy neighborhoods of Detroit behind my bicycle with all my tools on and mow the lawns of some of the more wealthier people.
For more than $2?
For more, $25 a lawn. These were big corner blocks that that my father helped me get started with and bought me a self-propelled lawnmower, and I took it from there. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, 12 or 13, and then...
And you were a collector at that point.
Oh, yeah. As a child, I collected everything and anything. I had stamp collection, coin collection, comic books, baseball player autographs. You know, it went through phases, and I still have remnants of all of that. My brother sold my comic books, but, you know, that's... neither here nor there.
Were you part of a large family?
Five children. So three boys, and that's more the childhood years. We were quite stretched out. My older brother and my youngest sister never lived in the same house because he went away to university at 18 and she was born. I left 4 years later. So so it was really two different families, a boy family, three boys. And then the two girls came late, and it was quite a different sort of setup. We were mama's boys, and they were daddy's girls.
And with your interest in when you did your first degree, what happened in your secondary schooling? How did you get into?
Well, I've graduated from high school, and I thought that my brother had been in the art school at the University of Michigan, and I used to spend weekends up visiting him and going to the art school and the architecture school shared premises, so I sort of nosed around in the studios in architecture and thought, oh, maybe I want to be an architect. I like the models. So I enrolled in architecture and did some of the prerequisites. It was two years of prerequisites before you could get in. And that's at the end of that second year and before the start of the actual course, by that stage in life, I had parlayed my lawn mowing businesses into estate gardening. I was an estate gardener for a wealthy family in Detroit. And while I was working on the estate, I thought, I really don't want to be an architect. I think I want to be a landscape architect. I like this outdoor stuff. I like the plants. I like the, I like where I am today. So I went back and changed into science, natural resources, as a way of preparing myself to enter landscape architecture later. I didn't want to change universities and go find a course somewhere else. I wanted to finish at Michigan. So I did natural resources and did a lot of the prerequisite kinds of things that I thought might lead to landscape architecture. So I did an urban planning class, I did soils, I did woody plants where I learned my plant materials. I did, you know, the whole, they'd had an interpretation class, they had a political science class. You know, so I had a very wide ranging degree in natural resources that set me up to get into landscape architecture later when after I graduated from Michigan.
I don't know, there's not a similar, although I'm not sure about this, but is there in Australia a degree in natural resources?
Is one at Armidale. They call it natural resources. Yeah, so natural resources, you know, might be called, you know, it grew out of the forestry school, mm-hmm. but the forestry and ecology, it was largely around national parks and land management and those kinds of things. So that's what the natural resources degree was. It was very wide ranging. I mean, you could have majored in forestry, you could have majored in, I don't know what, but I just did the generalist and a little bit of everything that the course offered. And then when I finally landed at Minnesota and asked to get in the course there, I had 90% of my prerequisites to get into that course. So I spent a year after my graduation from Michigan working for my fraternity. I traveled widely in the western states. I visited 55 or 60 campuses that year working for the fraternity. And while I was doing that, I was checking out all the landscape architecture courses around to see where I might want to go to school. And so I finished that year and went back to Detroit, fixed my dad's windows for $150, put the money in my pocket, jumped in the car and headed west and got as far as Minnesota, where I had tried to get in the course. They'd rejected me. And I went back and said, why didn't I get in? And they said, well, we hadn't met you. And we only took people that we had met. They wouldn't, you needed to interview. And he said, well, we've already started, but if you hang around next year, you're in. So I hung around for a year and went hunting and fishing and shooting and hung out with friends and did a few. I still had some prereqs to do, so I had to do art, surveying, and professional writing course. So I did some of those prereqs, and then the following year, which I don't know what year that would be, 1975 maybe, I started my landscape architecture degree, three-year mm-hmm. course.
Mm-hmm. And lived in Minnesota.
And lived in Minneapolis, which was a wonderful place to live. Beautiful city, designed by landscape architects, really. The park systems was laid out by a landscape architect named Horace Cleveland. I can't remember what his middle initials were, HWS Cleveland. So it was a beautiful city, you know, all connected, the lakes, cross-country skiing in winter, groomed trails everywhere, walking trails around all the lakes in the summer. Yeah,
hence your love of nature.
It enhanced it. I mean, it was a beautiful place to be. I'd been camping as a kid a lot, so I always enjoyed the outdoors. I played in the streets every day. So it's very physical upbringing, sport, you know, as part of that, baseball in the summer, basketball in the winter. So Minnesota was just, you know, all of that on steroids in a lot of ways. The wilderness area to canoe in the north, lakes and rivers to canoe on, outdoor sport. You know, everything was there. So it was a great place to study. I fell in with two different families who had sort of adopted me into their lives. And Minnesota nice is a thing, you know. People in Minnesota are lovely. And these two families just took me in. And one family was a hunting, fishing, shooting sort of family. And the other one was my professor and his eight kids. So I could go down to their house in the bush, or I could go out to the lakes and borrow the boat and go fishing and go to the cabin, you know, that kind of thing. So Minnesota was wonderful to me, and I thought that was where I was going to stay.
So what happened?
I was between jobs, and I've graduated.
Tell me about your first job then.
I graduated from landscape architecture in '79, I think, And my first job was with one of my lecturers, and we worked out of the basement of his house that he'd excavated under the house, and all the dirt that went outside became the badminton court next to the house. And he was a great he was really technically really oriented. And of course, landscape architecture in America was very technically oriented. We learned the structural engineering, we learned road design, we learned our levels, you know, earth forming, all our plant materials. Whereas in Australia at that time, landscape architecture was still very much sort of an ornamental gardening profession. You know, maybe a little bit more advanced, but it hadn't cracked into the more hard landscape, urban stuff that the American system had. So anyway, Jim Robin, my first job out, was the guy who taught us tech. And so it was a great grounding for me to work there. And I had by my side a good friend from my class who was also really technically skilled. So I learned a lot of my craft from Jim. And I also learned, I think, to trust your intuition. Jim was very quick. He would hit on an idea and it would be the right idea. You know, cause he'd trust himself to get a good idea straight up and then work from there. The professor with the eight kids, Herb, was my mentor. I spent a lot of time with him in the field or in the studio just as a friend. And he showed me his work, and he was the artiste, you know, beautiful, beautiful landscape architecture. Mm-hmm. So I had that really nice balance in my early training. But then I was also thinking I needed to I wanted to do further study. That was the thing to do. You graduate at the top of your class, which I did, and the expectation you would go to Harvard. Well, Harvard cost at that time $20,000. That was probably $2 million now, $200,000. But anyway, I didn't really want to go to Harvard. Everybody went to Harvard. I wanted to do something different, so I was casting around in England to study in England because it was English, spoke English. And anyway, while I was doing that, this is a long story. While I was doing that, I got, I needed a job. I went to see a professor of mine, another professor, Roger Martin, very influential in Minnesota, and asked Roger for a job with his company. And said, "Oh, look, I'm just back from my sabbatical in Australia at the University of Melbourne. I don't have any work for you. What are you doing with your life?" So I explained to him what I was doing about wanting to do a master's. He said, "Well, you should go to Australia." Oh, really? Okay. So they speak English. I'll test that out. And I sent a letter, and you know what's the possibilities and what would be the job opportunities while I was there, and da da da. And they sent me a letter offering me a job as a tutor in their master's program. I think through the back door, Roger had said something. He wouldn't admit it, never admitted it, but I think he must have said something because it was just too quick. And it was more money than I was making in America with the exchange rate at the time. So this is 1980, I'm applying. And so I arrived here in 81, and for a one-year contract that became two, that became three. And I really, I struggled at the Melbourne University, but I made, I made friends in the industry, particularly at RMIT with Jim Sinatra, who I'd met in America earlier when he was teaching in Iowa State. So I knew Jim and some of my classmates and some of his students, and we fell in, and that was quite a creative time. We organized the first Students of Landscape Architecture conference called The Edge, which I think, and people will say that it was a very influential moment in the profession of landscape architecture in Australia. We had about 300 people attended, 50 speakers. We had film showing, field trips, et cetera, et cetera. And again, it was about shifting the profession out of its ornamental gardening shell to the edge of the profession to say, look, we work with all these people in all these different ways. We had eco-philosophers, we had engineers, we had poets, we had musicians, we had all these different people that had influenced us as landscape architects. around us, you know, at the edge of our profession, in informing our profession, horticulturalist painters. It was quite an event.
And it sounds very exciting. What year was that?
That was 1983. That was the first Students of Landscape Architecture Conference, the EDGE.
Was there a course in Australia then called Landscape Architecture?
Yeah, there's a Master's of Landscape Architecture at Melbourne Uni, where I was teaching, and RMIT had a Bachelor of Landscape Architecture under Jim Sinatra. There were others. There was the University of New South Wales, Finn Torvaldsen, Alan Corey at University of Sydney, or maybe the other way around, I don't know. Brisbane had a course, and I don't know who was I've never met any of those folks at the time. Canberra had a course, Glenn Wilson, famous, a great Australian plantsman, and Ken Taylor was into cultural landscapes. So it was about to burst. You know, the profession was about to burst. The EDGE, I think, and IFLA conference that year, the year before in Canberra, sort of pushed it over the edge into to become the modern profession that it is now.
And what words would you use to describe landscape architecture now? You've described it as moving from a sort of horticultural plant space approach to how would you describe it?
We define it. I in writing the Australian Charter for Landscape Architects, I defined it as planning and design for life outside. So I was trying to give some idea of the skills, the tools we use, planning and design, and who we do it for, which is life, human life or natural life, and outside, so to distinguish us from buildings. The difference now, I think, is that we're much more technically proficient. There's a much stronger emphasis on the ecology of what we do, as opposed to just purely decorating with plants. We're probably more systems oriented than we were than decorators. I think we're, you know, George Seddon, you know, said we just put the rouge on the corpse, you know, and we were satraps to the rich and wealthy. And well, I think now we're working across a much broader society of projects, society of people in the projects we work for, and it's very diverse, you know. As I say, you know, we, as a profession, people are working at scale, you know, of one of my classmates was a landscape architect for the Park Service in Alaska, and she was on a committee of countries designing, you know, planning the Arctic Circle. You know, so that's the regional scale that we work at, and other friends are designing nuts and bolts, you know, they're putting together things at a different scale, and that some people work at a wilderness edge of the world, other people work at the center of the city. So there's scale and scope, and some people are visionary, they're just thinking up big ideas all the time, and other people are very technically oriented, you know. The difference between a Picasso drawing from the shoulder and a draftsman with a 0.18 pen.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Then at your time in Melbourne, did you continue to pursue your outdoor interest or was that that drove you to Tasmania? How did you
I mean, in Melbourne, yes, I still pursued the outdoors. I took up a friendship with a woman who was an outdoor educator at Wesley College, and so she started taking me with her boys on camping trips, where I discovered how unfit I was. So then I took up running around Melbourne, from the university campus, around Royal Park and all that. So I was doing that kind of thing. One of my students in my course, Francine Gilfeder, who's been very involved in the Garden History Society in Victoria, she was a rock climber. And on the first, I arrived in February, and by Easter I was out at Mount Arapiles hanging on a rope, climbing with her and her cohorts, Easter at Mount Arapiles. So I did that. I say the bushwalking trips on weekends and things like that. Kayaking, freshwater kayaking. I did a couple of trips, one with George Seddon, a famous trip with George, down the Snowy River, which led him to write a book about the Snowy River. Yeah, so I did a lot of all that. And then my thesis topic was about alternative living and alternative lifestyle. So I would travel up to northern New South Wales and spend time living on communes and visiting communes and seeing how their lifestyle accorded with an ecological or environmental ethic. Yeah. So yeah, no, my passion for the outdoors continued. In fact, I did come down in my final year at Melbourne Uni. I came down to go on a bushwalk. I was going to walk South Coast Tract of Tasmania with some friends. And but it was also the time of the blockade, the Franklin River blockade. So while I was waiting for them to arrive in Tasmania, I went over to Strawn and got engaged over there with Greeny Acres and the blockade movement, and ended up going upriver and abandoning my camping, my bushwalking idea, and stayed upriver as the cook for the upriver Franklin River camp, feeding 125 people a day and organizing all the food deliveries and that kind of thing. So I was upriver for probably a couple of weeks. I got sick, came back to town, got well, went back upriver for the final stages of the upriver campaign.
That was an extraordinary time.
It was, and it was really when I would say that my environmental values hardened. You know, I have to say, I'm an American kid, conservative family. I'm interested in the outdoors. I'm interested in ecology and attending rallies and all that sort of stuff. But I really, it hardened, the blockade hardened my resolve to just take that straight line approach to environmental consciousness from then on. So the blockade was very formative. A funny story, when I got my first job here in Tasmania, so I went back to uni and finished up and came down here at the end of that 3 years at Melbourne Uni to say goodbye because my visa was going to expire. And I went to a party and somebody said, oh, you know, there's a job at Scott and Furphy Engineers. You should go over there and see if they'll hire you. So I went to Scott and Furphy. I got the job. Just after finishing negotiating the deal with the boss, I'm trying to walk out the door and leave. And he says, by the way, you're not a greenie, are you? And I said, well, boss, I wouldn't call myself that, but I have to say I agree with most of what they have to say. And he said to me, oh, all right, just don't tell anybody. So for the first month, I kept quiet about it all. But after a month, I went into the photocopy room, and the two secretaries cornered me and made me tell my story. But by then, I'd proven myself, and so my green credentials were acceptable. And yeah, and that time at Scott and Furphy was very good. They just, as long as I made money for them, they let me do what I wanted to do. And so I pioneered a lot of, pioneered practice my way of training. So I was doing my own levels, doing a lot of my own engineering with their advice. But they were surprised that I could do a lot of the things that they were doing.
What sort of projects?
Most at that time, it was largely Housing Commission and Department of Construction projects. So Burnie Library, the Burnie Police Station, Burnie TAFE, New Norfolk Library, Orford Library. Those were some of the early projects, and then housing department subdivisions all over. But the thing that I was trying to do, the satellite tracking station up the hill. So, and that project was the first demonstration of saying to people, let's collect the seed for the plants that we're going to use from within 1 kilometer of the site. So I engaged a young fella who now runs a big landscaping company to go out and collect the seed. We grew it on, and we used it as our plants. And I'm doing a lot of work with indigenous plants, trying to use indigenous plants for everything. I was a bit of a plant fascist about my selection of plants, trying to push that ecological line that the joke I would make, say if somebody dropped a neutron bomb and all the people were gone, the plants would just take over and do their thing, and we'd all, the earth would be healed. So we're doing a lot of that with Scott and Furphy. And it was a really good time. I was able to work hard. I finished my master's thesis using their computers at night. And I learned a lot from the engineers, and it was able, like I say, was able to pioneer ways of working that hadn't been in the profession, at least certainly not in Tasmania, but even elsewhere, very limited. The indigenous plant thing grew out of a group in Melbourne, but they were pioneering it, so I wasn't far behind them really in what they were doing. And certainly in Tasmania, it was a new thing.
So early in your time in Tasmania, you were involved in bringing the British founder of Common Ground, Susan Clifford, to Tasmania. She was passionate about nature and a sense of place. Can you tell us about her visit and the response here to the ideals of Common Ground?
Right. After Scott and Furphy, I set up my own business, and I was always interested in the role of public art in the possibilities for public art in the landscape. And so through my early work with Scott and Furphy, the Rosny Library in particular, I was introduced to Arts Tasmania, Lynn Smith at the time, Lynn Upton now, and worked with Lynn quite a bit on projects. Every state government project had to have public art, so I was working with her. And we ended up at a conference in Melbourne at the same time, and Susan was the keynote speaker. And from opposite sides of the room, we both sort of made a beeline to her afterwards and said, "We want you to come to Tasmania." And so she agreed, and a year later she came out. And around her visit, between Lynn and myself and others, we organized a whole series of events to try and raise awareness about the role of art, in Susan's words, as a prism through which to see nature. So we had a 5-day or 6-day event down at Fortescue Bay with sculptors and doing works in nature down there. We had Ray Arnold did a thing up in Perth with truckies in their photographs. We had a poet and a double bass player on the ferry going back and forth every night reciting poetry and performing. What's called the Fairies Project that Marjorie Luck at Clarence Council helped organize. And then we had a one-day seminar at the end where we, again, thinking about this edge of the profession, we had a landscape architect, an architect, photographer, musician, poet. We had a range of speakers all talking about the role of nature informing their work and the way that their work informed others about nature. So that was the great thing about Susan's visit. It was very formative, again, it was about 125 people. It really, again, took the art and the role of art in the landscape out to a lot of people and opened the door for them. I remember Julie Payne, who is Robert Morris Nunn's partner, saying how influential that was in her thinking and in her career, that moment. But that was a really significant event. And for me, it was one of several events that led to the book Our Common Ground, which was the first publication by the Institute of Landscape Architects, which was a recording, transcript of all the recordings from that day. And it was one of a series of events. And the next event involved Alan Gussow, the American painter, coming out. I organized for Alan to come. I had met Alan as a student at Minnesota and understood his emphasis on sense of place and the value of drawing out the essence of place into your work rather than homogenizing things in an international style. So we had a wonderful event with Alan when he was here. And then another year later, I was on the committee that organized the National Institute of Landscape Architects Conference in collaboration with the National Architects and the National Planners. So I was able to influence the speakers program for that, again, in this broad sense, focusing on sense of place as well. So that was a really intense period of activity in my life in the 90s, early 90s, mid-90s.
And pretty groundbreaking kind of area.
Oh, yeah.
Not just the Tasmania, Australia, but probably worldwide.
My profession, landscape architecture, is evolving this whole time, internationally and nationally, to be a much more broad profession it is now. That's sort of my extracurricular vocational activities. Professionally, in 1986 or 87, I did the Waverly Floor Park Management Plan, and that is sort of a groundbreaking. That's an award over there. I was looking to see the date, but I can't read it. The Waverly Floor Park Management Plan was a career establishing project for me. I won two national awards. First time any Tasmanian won a National Landscape Architecture Award. And it was a land management plan for a natural area here in Hobart that had significant natural values. It's surrounded by suburbs, but had 280 species of plants and 20 species of orchids, and some of them were rare and threatened and all that. And so in writing that management plan and winning that award, it sort of set off a ripple through the whole state of other communities saying, well, we've got an area, we've got a Waverly Floor Park kind of project. So can you come to Latrobe? Can you come to Devonport? Can you do two or three more in Clarence and write these land management plans? And they became increasingly bigger and more involved, where we eventually, with my business partner friend at the time, John Hepper, we won the job to do the land management plan for the Army, for the Defense Forces at Buckland, to the 22,000 hectare site. And on that project, we had 20 sub-consultants working under us to collect the data we needed to write a land management plan for defense. That won the next national award for us. And then Mount Wellington, Wellington Park Management Plan.
I'd like you to talk more about that, because that seems to me it captures a whole range of your experiences and your expertise in terms of that management plan and the focus on sense of place and the importance of Kunani to Hobart and surrounds.
Yeah, well, that was off the back of this whole series of land management plans. John and I, and a group of others, I think there were six or eight others on the team, pulled together the information to write the first management plan for Mount Wellington. Our plan was rejected by our committee because we took quite a radical approach. We tried to base it on the intrinsic value of nature, which is the value of nature above and beyond human needs. And it was quite a complex bit of philosophy in there, but it did touch on a lot of things that I'd been thinking about and we'd been talking about professionally and at the edges. Again, the deep ecology movement, I was heavily influenced by a couple of deep thinkers here at the university at the time.
Peter Hay, was that one?
Sorry?
Peter Hay?
Oh, Pete. No, Pete. I knew Pete, but more as Robin Eckersley and Warwick Fox were writing their PhDs at the time, and they were both into this notion of transpersonal ecology. And Pete would have been too. Pete was their supervisor. But I didn't know Pete as well then as I do now. But Robin and Warwick managed to get Arnie Nass to come to Australia, and Arnie and Bill DeVal, Arnie was the originator of the idea of deep ecology. It's deeper than just green, not just a utilitarian value for nature, but nature having a value of itself. So we tried to weave that into the management plan. It's all a bit too hard for parks to manage, so they created zones and their usual way of managing things. But it was a really exciting time, and the volume that we wrote as a background document is still very highly regarded as the definitive work about Mount Wellington in terms of depth of study. In fact, Jamie Kirkpatrick borrowed our bibliography to use in his book on Mount Wellington. So it, uh, But yeah, that so Mount Wellington's interesting for us as a practice. So around 1996, well, I got married in 96, so I must have had a baby in 98. We formed Inspiring Place about 1998. So that came out of John and I having worked together on many projects over the previous 10 years as independent practices, and as in time our workload became more and more overlapping, and we said, oh, if we can ever come up with a good name, we'll make a company. My wife and I were brainstorming one night the name of a book, thinking we needed to do another book, came up with the notion of an Inspiring Place. Kate says she thought of it. My memory is not that good. But yeah, so I'll credit Kate with finding the name Inspiring Place. And I said, that's too good a name for a book. It'd be wasted. It's the name of our company. And I rang John, said, John, it's Inspiring Place. He said, that's it. And 2 weeks later, the company was formed, you know, paper signed, and Inspiring Place is off and running from 1998. So in that, you know, between, and Wellington Park Management Plan was before that, but since then, after that, we've come down in scales. So we've done site plans for the springs. So, you know, coming down from that whole of park, 52,000 hectares, down to a site management plan, site master plan, down to detailed design. So just recently, we designed the playground at Ferntree Park. So, you know, we get down to that nuts and bolts. There's that professional scale thing, the scope from from policy all the way through to detailed design. And from the wild through to the urban, you know. So Mount Wellington is a good demonstration of how I see the profession. I've got a little diagram it's a series of nested circles. It starts at politics. It goes to policy, goes to planning, goes to design, goes to construction. These nested things. And they happen within the milieu of values, economy, the biophysical environment, and something else. I can't remember what the other one is. But those things inform those different layers. And at any one time, you could be working. You should be thinking about the next layer up and the next layer down. So if we're doing a master plan, we're actually thinking about how it's going to be designed, you know. So some master plans are just a series of bubbles. We tend to go into it even further to make sure that it's going to work. And then if we're doing a master plan, we also try to understand it in a policy framework. What's the recreation strategy for this community? What's the open space strategy? How does this park master plan, say, fit into that? And sometimes we end up in the political realm, you know, where it's a political decision to do something or not to do something, or you know, the job comes out of politics for some reason, or the politicians come down on you and say you can't do that. We had one thing said, if you do that, all of this is going to fall over for you. So we've had the pointed finger from a minister once upon a time.
So the Mount Wellington, the management plan, in fact, stood in good stead when with the latest proposal for having a cable car. Because that it would have run totally counter to all of the basic principles in the management.
It did. At the time, though, the Act, the Wellington Park Management Act, that we were working under back then, that's 1996 or something, had provision for the Skyway in it. And so when we wrote the management plan, we also wrote the guidelines against which the Skyway had to be assessed. And so we wrote a very rigorous set of principles that they had to address and process that they had to go through before they would get approval. And
that helped.
I don't know if it helped or not, but I know that people were digging around for it, coming in here, asking us for copies of our plan and asking us for copies of all that and to see how they could put it to use. So, but it certainly, again, with our own hardened resolve, we were definitely opposed to it and did everything we could to support the people around it. My best friend is the lawyer that ran the case, and we recommended the visual management expert that did the work for the community that was quite influential in the cable car being rejected. So as professionals, we have to keep our powder dry. We get blackballed. So we tend to support in other ways. We do pro bono work for people. Rosny Hill Group, we did pro bono work for them. We've said no to working on any number of other projects, including the current proposal for high performance AFL center over in Clarence. So if we had an influence on Mount Wellington, that's great. If you think that, that's wonderful.
I find it quite a contrast when I was the other project I wanted to ask you about was the development of Sapphire in Freycinet. And I was just amused when I read, having just heard you describe the complexity of approach for Mount Wellington and the management plan, the project's architect came to you to help with the development of, and they said the brief was, prepare landscapes designs for the area around our building.
Yeah.
That was their brief. I'm thinking, what understanding did they have about landscape architecture?
Well,
tell me about it.
Well, there's two different architects, right? The project started with one firm who were very determinist in how they treated the landscape, and we were there to facilitate their vision of what the landscape should be. They really didn't want our opinion in a lot of ways. We managed to change that in time, and we managed to create a philosophy around the project that would have worked and would have made their building better. But then they were moved on. I don't know what the agreement was, but they moved on, and then Morris Nunn Architects took over Peter Walker, and Peter was much more engaged with us as landscape architects and what we could do to extend the value of their architecture. So there's different architects who want you to work in different ways. Some only want you to facilitate their vision, and if that's clear at the outset, we can do that, and we're happy to do that. We'll, if you know, they want an X in the landscape, we'll make an X and make it work. Others say, well, there's a whole alphabet of possibilities. How, just show us what those possibilities are. So Peter was much more open to that, and we advanced an ecological vision for the site. So we collected seed, we grew that on, we grew 700 advanced trees, we grew 3,000 shrubs before we even started work. With the first architects, they went to tender, and in advance of the tender, they cleared the building site, which was huge. And so in clearing the site, we collected the soil, took that off-site, and stored it in a way that the soil stayed healthy. We took whole plants and we moved them into areas that were disturbed but weren't going to be built on. So we started the process of ecological restoration early on. So we had ideas like, you know, that we use terms like keep healthy landscapes healthy, repair damage that we've done, manage the waters of life. So we worked out how to manage the water on the site so that we didn't have to put it in stormwater and ship it off. We talked about managing the night light. You know, everything's got, all the lights have to project down, no bright lights, no car park lighting. We talked about, and because we wanted to put telescopes in every room so that people could look at the stars at night, because the East Coast stars are amazing. So we had a whole series of principles that we were then applied to the site, and most of it eventuated. And noise was another thing. We wanted to, you know, didn't want to hear a lot of air conditioners at night. So they're all soundproofed, and so the quiet of the place was respected. So yeah, that was Sapphire. I mean, we moved the soil back onto the site later on and used that. And the one place the plants have failed is where we had to use imported soil. We ran out. We were able to use stone from the site for various decorative elements. Everything. We did everything we could to make it of the place. And to, you know, we did a thing later on with the Australian Institute of Landscape Architects wanted to test the American LEED system, which is an environmental accreditation system. And so we ran Sapphire through that their process and came out at the top of their, you know, it would have been a top-rated environmental project if it had been done under this American system. So I'm very happy with that result. And I think the client's very happy with what they have. They trim it a bit too much now. I've seen pictures of that sort of hedge cut and stuff. But and the banksias that we planted in the little courtyards, which were sort of bonsai shaped at the when they went in, are just enormous now. So, you know, you live and learn. But the 700 trees have taken off, and it is ecologically sound. You know, even though they're pruned, the plants are of the place, and so the habitat values hopefully are there, and hopefully the New Holland mouse, which was on the site, has survived, and the areas that didn't get used are very healthy and and that. So very happy with Sapphire. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, as George said, and it said it is, though, palace eunuch for the filthy rich. But, you know, I'd rather have one tourist spending $2,000 a night than 2,000 tourists spending $1 a night, because I think the impact is less. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another project you're involved in was at Rosny Park, and you've had the privilege of going back looking at what happened 30 years later.
Oh, the library.
The library.
Yeah. The library was a Scott and Furphy project, and it was the first real expression of a philosophy or a concept that ended up applying all through my career, of a cultured core and a wild edge. So the cultured core is where, you know, the closer you get to the back door, the more edible the landscape should be. So you can go out of the kitchen and pick a piece of parsley or whatever. And then the further away you should go, you should be moving back into nature. So on that project, the cultured core was an avenue of crab apple trees. And it was first of all, it was a reorientation of the site. The architect had it wrong. The site planning was wrong and didn't allow for good movement through the site, and it didn't connect with the mines on the one end and the council chambers on the other and the shopping center further along. So I reoriented the car parking, created a spine through the site that connected all those different elements within the city, mines, library, council chambers, and Eastlands. And then having done that, used that spine as the avenue of crabapple trees, which look beautiful in the spring, our own Sakura, with the avenue of crabapple trees. But I framed that within a wild exterior of indigenous trees from the area. And in doing that, it connects physically through the cultured core, but it connects visually with the hillsides around. And if you stand back, it's hard to tell where the site begins and ends, because the trees on the wild perimeter are the same trees that are on the hills around. And that was the idea of it, you know, and also to create ecological connection so that swift parrots can move through the site, or whatever kind of birds can move through the site. Native hens can come up and peck at the lawn.
You did go back 30 years later, and it survived.
The framework is there, and that was the. In fact, I wrote that article for a friend who was writing a book about the framework. That what's the influence of the people maintaining? You know, we have an idea, we put it there, we build it, and walk away. Somebody takes care of it, and in the maintenance, what changes? And I was very pleased to see that the framework had remained. And that the gardeners had understood, you know, some hedging that I wanted to become a hedge in time to create a screened courtyards. They'd understood that. They trimmed it. The corridor of crabapples had survived. The indigenous trees were still all there. The understory plantings were still all indigenous. So I was very happy with that one.
So much of our special lands, Tasmanian landscapes, have been lost to development, so it's really good to hear that one has survived, and it's been a really good really good development.
I have to say, in my profession, suffers from people not understanding what you've done and not appreciating the value of what you've done and what you went through, and we'll just chop that tree down because we can grow another one, instead of valuing longevity. So a lot of projects do suffer. A lot of turnover. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's hard to see where you've been sometimes, you know. Mm-hmm. You go back to a site and say, what did I manage to do here? All that's left is the stepping fence or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. None of the trees, none of the shrubs, everything's changed. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah.
And I'm just thinking there's a furor going on in Melbourne with councils now declaring that people moving bylaws, did you see that in some of the suburbs, that they need to get permission before they cut trees down? And there's absolute some of the outer suburbs.
Well, Melbourne's been very good at tightening up on tree removal. And they've got very good street trees. They've got a very good greening strategy, street trees in particular. And they have a lot of good protections around that I've tried to institute here when I wrote the City of Hobart Street Tree Master Plan.
Mm-hmm. What's the status of this now? How's that developed?
Well, Ruby, the arborist, has implemented, I think she says, 28 out of 30 recommendations. She's been sensational at implementing and getting it going. And you can start to see, I mean, trees take a long time to mature and get big and achieve what you want to achieve. But I walk around the city and I can see where Ruby's been with her team planting trees and maintaining trees and sticking them in wherever they can. So I think in time the city will get to its target of whatever canopy cover it was, 40% or something. So we set targets. And again, we relied on Melbourne. In fact, I had a woman who wrote the Melbourne Street Tree Strategy as a peer reviewer for my work on that project. And it drew a lot on theirs. But I think the value of what I tried to do was, there's a lot of statements around motherhood statements, parenthood statements around trees that, trees make you healthy and trees make, get rid of this and that. So I went and tried to find the real sources of that information and put it into the strategy so somebody could go to the journal and the journal article and the medicine that says green is good for your health, rather than just the parenthood statement that green is good for your health. This is the scientific evidence that somebody accumulated and wrote up.
Mm-hmm. The Australian Garden History Societies, in Tasmania, we've joined forces with National Trust to resurrect the Significant Tree Project, which is trying to encouraging people to protect and get onto the register, the National Trust register, significant trees.
Mm.
So, and City of Hobart was probably instrumental in their own creating their own register, but the master plan is also pushing that.
Well, the master off the back of the master plan, Ruby really went for it on the significant tree register, and they really, really expanded it dramatically in the last couple of years. Includes my tree out front.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you've talked about some pro bono work, but you've done a lot of it over your career. The South Hobart Community Garden, are you still involved with that? Is that Mona's 24 carat gardens?
Yes. Well, South Hobart Community Garden is just me needing a plot of land. I live here in the city and don't have any room for vegetables, so I gave it a crack, but we travel too much, and so I've abandoned my plot up there. But I was the plot manager. Yeah. I helped by organizing. When somebody said they would like a plot, I said, well, there's one free, and I did that for 5 years maybe. So that was a bit of fun. And I still go up. I take my compost up there and say hello and grab a Chilean guava off a plant or something every now and again. I have a raspberry. So that's that. The 24 carat gardens started. The first couple were pro bono, but we've become a little bit more commercial about that. The rest of the team's doing those projects. We're getting paid a little bit. We're trying to cover staffing costs, but very proud of our work. Bridgewater, Kingston High School, Kingston Primary School, Ravenswood. So yeah, the community gardening is ongoing, and that's a nice thing. I mean, I volunteered us to do that when I was still a director of the company. Adam, who's one of the new directors, has taken it on with a passion. He's from a horticultural background and has his own veggie patch and all that. So it's been really good extension and part of the evolution of Inspiring Place into a new ownership, new mindsets. Jordan and Adam have taken over, but they're very like-minded to us, which is nice, and maybe even do what we do better. You know, certainly Adam's a better gardener than I am. I had terrible success. I'm not a green thumb. I was good at maintenance, really good at maintenance. You know, I can mow a lawn with the best of them, take care of a garden bed, you know, keep it weed free, et cetera, et cetera. But it's actually getting things to grow myself. That's Kate's job. That's my wife's job.
Yeah. So we're leading into where you're talking about what the future of your, not only your company, but landscape architecture. Do you have comments about, as we move into the future, where do you see landscape architecture going?
I am, look, as far as where the company's going, I think the company's staying on the course that we've been on over the years. Jordan and Adam have a good range of skills, not quite the breadth that John and I had, so we're looking for people to fill some of the roles that John and I played in the company, but I think the company will continue to do excellent work and will break ground as new ideas come and evolve. As far as the profession goes, it's interesting. I think the profession has gained a lot of credibility, a lot of respect, particularly through some the success of some projects. I'm thinking of Taylor Cullity and Left Lane and the work that they've done over the years in interstate and overseas, particularly the Australian Garden at Cranbourne. So people see that we're capable of taking things on and capable of leading projects, and that there's an alternative way to do the landscape that isn't led by an architect. Architects want to build things. We want to grow things. So when we lead projects, they take a different emphasis. We still put buildings in the landscape or, you know, shelters or whatever, toilet blocks, but our emphasis is different. It's not so hardscaped as an architect might make it. So we're getting more and more respect from clients and from architects to let us have those roles and take those approaches. I do feel like having created a very broad profession, and particularly, you know, going to the edges and working at all those edges, that some of those edges are being clipped off a little bit by specialists. So to survive in Tasmania for as long as we have, John and I, we've had to be generalists. So we've done one visual impact analysis a year, one park master plan a year, da-da-da-da-da. But over 30 years, you've done 30 of each of those. So you're a generalist working across a really broad range of ideas and piecing those ideas together into maybe a singular project, bringing the ecology in, bringing this in, bringing that in to make a project. But those if those were silos, those silos are being picked off a little bit. So where we used to do lots of recreation management plans for municipalities and shires and stuff, there's now companies that specialize in recreation management planning. So they're doing that. And I think they're not doing as good a job because they're not seeing it across that breadth. Mm-hmm. So again, we would bring into a recreation management plan, we would bring open space management, we would bring ecology, we would bring urban design or architecture, all those things into it, and give it a depth that the specialist in that area isn't mm-hmm. giving it. So so my fear is that those, you know, horticulture, some landscape architects, Paul Thompson, Glenn Wilson, Michael Wright, Kath Rush, all really excellent horticulturalists. But more and more firms are hiring a horticulturalist to support them. So landscape architects are losing. If you don't have that skill, you hire somebody. So there's now people that horticulturalists that are just doing the job rather than us leading it and designing with it or And so it becomes a collection of plants rather than an organization of plants, shaping a landscape, articulating the way the plants are used.
So you think you need, again, this is what happens, the wheels go around your conference of the 1980s, The Edge, bringing all those people together.
It's funny you say that, because I've been talking about it with a colleague in Victoria about doing a conference, and it would be very much along those lines again. Keeping the, if I just don't want to see the, and even with, you know, levels planning, earth forming, you know, let the engineers do that. Stay away from it. It's too risky. And I think, I don't want the engineers telling me how to shape it, where the pits have to be, because that, you know, nothing worse than a pit in the middle of your footpath, you know, because that's where the engineer says it should be to make it work right. You know, I understand that pit could have been off to the side, or it could have been over here, or we could shape it around and do it differently. So, I think that's what we might be losing, and I keep reminding these guys not to let it go. Hand drawing skills have disappeared. You know, that I don't think I draw that well, but they're all going, wow, you know, look at that, you know, because I'm drawing by hand still. I can't open a computer file. And that capacity to draw freehand and to think by hand first is really valuable. It opens up things that, you know, I'll trace every contour, you know, just to get a sense of what the land's doing at that level before I then start to try and change it. But also in discussion with a client, that I can draw in front of them in a way that inspires them to accept my ideas, whereas you can't do that on a computer. So I think that there's something being lost in the computerization of things. And
let alone AI.
Yeah, and all the precedent images thing. You know, we now rely on precedent images a lot to try and illustrate to clients what they might be getting, or the general sense of what they might be getting. But on the other hand, there's always been that issue of taking the precedent images and just repeating it. And AI, that's what AI does. AI does, it says, oh, here's all the precedents, I'll grab this and put it here. And that's a worry, you know, just repeating the same thing from somewhere else. So you lose that connection with place, you lose that specificity of the local condition and the local opportunity and the local community, whether it be plant community or people community. I think on the positive side, our profession is engaging much more thoroughly and meaningfully with the Aboriginal communities around us and understanding their ways of being in the landscape and trying to bring that into a modern landscape environment. That's a real positive gain that's happening. I think the profession continues to expand and gain credibility. It's a much, much different. I mean, when I moved here, there were three or four of us in landscape architecture, and now there's 25. And, you know, there was one or, you know, you could almost name all the practices on the mainland, and now there's hundreds, you know. And hundreds to the point where people are moving out into the regions, you know, and setting up practices in Ballarat and Bendigo and on the Gold Coast and, you know, Broken Hill. You know, there's practices out in the regions, which I think is important, you know. So bringing those values from our profession into those areas that might be very conservative in their thinking or their politics or whatever, but also just not exposed to what's happening in the cities that might be valuable to them out there. So,
mm-hmm. Important. We're coming to the end, I think. Any other areas that I haven't covered?
One other project I'm quite proud of and really enjoyed was the
work. That was one of my questions.
The work on Cape Barron Island. Uh-huh. Because that was, you know, it's a remote community. 90 people live on the island. 90% of them are Aboriginal people. A lot of unemployment. And the invitation to go up there and design around their new community hub. So they built three buildings. They built a admin center, a post office, and a shop all together, and to be able to do the landscaping around that. And so I invited an artist friend, Maggie Fook, a trained horticultural teacher, Paul Rigby, and myself, and then Herbert Staubman grew the plants from Habitat Nursery. And we provided not only the design and the landscape, but we also provided the training. We used four of the local unemployed people to build the landscape, and we brought TAFE to the project, and TAFE ran courses for these. You know, they learned OH&S skills, they learned concrete, they learned horticulture, they got certificates in a number of different things. And then Maggie worked with the community to do art, to bring art into the landscape. So the kids in the schools identified three or four different things of their place, grass trees, Cape Barren geese, something else. And so Maggie worked with them to do clay things that we inserted into the pavement of those ideas. And then the conceptual design was based around kelp on the beach, you know, the strand lines on the beach. And so Maggie identified how to do that by creating concrete sets. You know, a set was a small block, like a granite paver. But we did them in concrete, and to do that, we collected all of the milk cartons on the island. You know, the milk that comes in box cartons. You cut that in half. It's perfect formwork for concrete. So she put colored concrete in that, and then that became the kelp beads running through the concrete areas. And in the end, most of the materials came from the island, other than the plants, which. We collected seed and cuttings and grew them on and brought them back. All the granite that we used to make the retaining walls, all the tea tree we used for the screens and fencing, everything except cement really came from the island. So out of the project budget, I would say that 90% of the money stayed on the island in wages and in purchase of materials and accommodation and food for us when we were there. And I think that was a real benefit. You know, it had all the aspects of sustainability, including a sustainable economy. So I'm really pleased with that. That won a couple of awards, but really the value was in working with the people and being there. And it was a great experience, really great experience. So that's one project that I'm quite happy with, but. Yeah, Waverly Flora Park, Cape Barren Island, Buckland Military Training Area, Wellington Park, those are all noteworthy projects. And in recent times, working with the team here while they developed the lily pads in the Botanic Gardens, which won National Award of Excellence. So that's one of the more recent big wins for us. You know, Edwina, Chris Sherman, Adam, Jordan, myself all had a hand in that. In different ways.
Mm. And I think I encourage anybody who's listening to this to come and see the lily pads at Hobart's Botanic Gardens. They're truly beautiful.
Mm.
And a final question, which picks up a bit on your talking about Cape Barren Island and sustainability. How do you think climate change is impacting, you know, the preservation of cultural landscapes? What are you seeing?
Well, certainly in our mind. We have to, you know, daily with projects, we're having to deal with potential sea level rise, looking at floor levels, looking at, potential inundations and that kind of thing. And in the plant world, we're starting to talk about and starting to listen to the experts about how the plant materials are going to shift, how things are going to change. I just said something the other day to somebody, we should use a lily pili here on this project. And she said, oh, it's not native to Tasmania. And I said, well, it will be one day soon. So we need to start thinking about what plants are going to replace. I mean, my favorite street tree is a lime, a Tilia cordata. But the experts are telling us that might not be appropriate in Tasmania anymore in the long term. So I've got to start finding a new plant. Maybe it's lily pili, I don't know. New street trees. And so there's certainly a lot of thought going into that from a climate change perspective. And then our own contribution, you know, trying to minimize our use of concrete or using newer carbon-reduced concrete and carbon-reduced materials, thinking about, you know, clay pavers versus concrete when we can afford it. I mean, capital, many clients won't afford you the investment to do things properly. So it's harder. But yeah, materiality, we're thinking about dark skies all the time, which isn't a climate change issue, but certainly a pollution, light pollution. And emissions and life cycle, trying to use wood rather than plastic in our play equipment. But there's horses for courses sometimes when recycled plastic materials are the right thing too. So it's a constant point of discussion. Mm-hmm. And we've looked into it. For Mona, we did look into it quite deeply. We looked at all of them. They have a system called RED, R-E-D-D, I think, and it's a system of evaluating the environmental impact of your materials and their life cycle cost and that kind of thing. So we had quite a deep investigation at that time around mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you so much. So in conclusion, I just wanted to say that more than 30 years ago, you wrote of the Common Ground Movement that their work shows us that by being in touch with and being touched by nature, we find our place in the scheme of things and learn to see the planet as not only a gift and opportunity, but also as a responsibility to be nurtured and cherished. I think you would still hold this now in 2024?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I'm very, very proud to have said that and continue trying to meet those ideals.
Mm-hmm. So it's been a great pleasure to speak with you today. And as you know, the Australian Garden History Society aims to promote awareness and conservation of significant gardens and cultural landscapes. And I think you have clearly demonstrated the contribution your profession is making to this aim. So thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.